I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, the 9th of July, and since our previous episode, which we recorded this day last week, nearly 1.5 million more infections have been recorded around the world, according to the Johns Hopkins University tracker, and the total now stands at over 12 million infections. Over 33,000 people have died in that week with COVID-19. The global death toll has now reached over 550,000. In Ireland, there have been a further 6 deaths reported to the Department of Health as of this evening, bringing total fatalities to 1,743, and 23 more confirmed cases brings the Irish total to 25,565. Now, in today's episode, we're going to have an in-depth look at Taiwan, which, despite its proximity to China and a direct flight path with Wuhan at the time of the initial outbreak, it has recorded only 7 deaths from COVID-19. I'll be talking to Samson Ellis, the Taipei Bureau Chief with Bloomberg, about that. Also, this.
The same thing could definitely happen in Ireland in a few weeks' time. Like, a few days ago, we sort of thought we were okay. And then, boom, they locked down.
A word of warning from Down Under. RTE's Jackie Fox has been talking to Irish people in Melbourne, where the lockdown is back. But first today, our freshly briefed correspondent, Sinead Crowley. How are you, Sinead?
I'm very well, thank you, Colm.
Good, freshly briefed as you are from the Department of Health. Will we begin this evening with the R number, something we've been keeping an eye on over the last while. But in case anyone's forgotten, what is it, why is it important, and where is it at the moment?
Yeah, the R number is the number at which the virus reproduces in the community. So we get updates of this every Thursday. And for a while there, it had been hovering around the 0.5 mark, which was seen as extremely positive, because essentially that means if 2 people have COVID-19, then they're only passing it on to 1 other person. And if that was to continue, the virus would, as they say, burn itself out. Now, we saw a slight rise last week. They were keeping an eye on it. But today we have seen a rise up to 1 or slightly over. Now, Professor Philip Nolan did point out again, the numbers they're working with are low. So that impacts on the modelling. But yes, it has risen. There has been a rise in the past 14 days in the number of new cases. So it's worth noting that as you're looking at the cases, you know, it's easy to take one day or another day or saying there's been a jump. But what they do is they look at a 14-day instance to give them a proper picture. And that does see the R number rising to 1 or over it. Now, he didn't say he was sending a note of alarm so much as a note of caution, that this is definitely something they're keeping an eye on, and appealed again to individuals to keep an eye on their own behaviour where that's concerned.
And it, rather than being spread out, it's clusters and outbreaks. That's the cause for his caution. He outlined some of the detail on that as well.
He did, yeah. And very interesting tonight in terms of the age profile of people as well. And I suppose you would expect there to be a change in the last couple of weeks. We did see that big reopening of society, and we know now that restaurants are open and people are gathering. And so I suppose you would, to an extent, expect to see some sort of a rise. But what was fascinating tonight and, you know, stark is that all of the cases, there's 23 new cases today, and all of them were in people under the age of 44, and 77% of them were in people under the age of 25. So you can see there a complete change in a profile where, you know, months ago you were talking about nursing homes and so on. Now you are talking about younger people, and they are out and about and they are meeting. And Dr. Ronan Glynn said, you know, that's not expected as measures are easing. And he said he didn't want to target a particular group. He said it's not about blame, but he did say that people have to protect each other. And he pointed out, look, you can get on with activities, but you have to do so safely. And he was asked about, for example, the scenes that we saw in pubs last weekend. They certainly don't want to see them replicated. And it's clear that, we've seen the pictures, and I suppose the sense is that social distancing might go out the window in certain social situations. And that's not helping. So they are asking people to remember the social distancing and to keep that at the forefront of their minds at all times.
Well, we have a look at travel before we get to masks then, Sinead, because this is, I suppose, the clearest area where there has been very much a difference of opinion between people making political decisions and people giving public health advice.
Yeah, and once again, NPHET has never been in two minds about this. NPHET has always said it advises against non-essential travel, and NPHET did meet today, and again, the advice is that non-essential travel overseas should be avoided. So obviously that is advice that goes to the government. It's up to the government as to what they do with it, but the advice from NPHET couldn't be more clear. And they were also asked about some of the new cases in the country at the moment are related to travel. 15 of today's confirmed cases are directly or indirectly related to travel. Now, that doesn't mean that those 15 people travelled abroad, but it could be that somebody or the one person travelled abroad and then passed it on in the community. But essentially, they are related to travel, and that's clearly something they're keeping an eye on. Dr. Glynn also saying that they discussed airports at NPHET today and, you know, maybe to increase the visibility of the public health advice at airports, make sure people know what they're doing. He was asked, you know, if it's the case that people are not quarantining, because I suppose anecdotally and in other ways, we feel that people aren't sticking to the quarantine measures when they come in. As we know, they're not mandatory, they're just advisory.
And it's just followed up with a phone call. People basically have to self-declare that they're following the quarantine, so it's not enforced, really.
Exactly, and he said that was clearly a concern. But he reiterated that his hope in the first place was that people didn't go out to travel, and then that for those who are coming in, he said, we'll continue to give clear guidance and hope that people follow that.
Right. Unfortunately, for this episode of this podcast, your attempts to winkle out what countries had shown up in cases that had been related to travel, your attempt to get a list of those countries, you're not going to get them till Monday. So sadly, too late for this particular episode.
No, but it will be interesting to see them on Monday. And I think, again, that question, and I asked that question, it was in relation to this idea of an air bridge or a green list, because NPHET is saying no overseas travel, but clearly the government has indicated that it is going to discuss air bridges and discuss a green list. So it will be fascinating to see if, for example, those cases from travel are linked to countries that, you know, that people would avoid anyway. I mean, I think it would be fairly obvious that you wouldn't be travelling to the USA, for example, at the moment, or, you know, other areas. But there are other countries that we know that have been lower than us all along. So it will be very interesting to see where those countries are, and it looks like we will get a breakdown of on Monday.
Right. I suppose there are two issues that are somewhat related. Airborne transmission was one thing that was covered. There was some reassurance on that. The other one is masks. So let's do airborne transmission first. This was the WHO was out earlier
yes.
on the news at one in RTE talking about this, but it did come up again at the Department of Health briefing. What was covered?
Yeah, Dr. Killian de Gascoigne was at the briefing this evening, and he was asked about the Irish view on airborne transmission, which would, of course, have a huge impact on how people are living their lives if even 2 metres wasn't enough, or if the virus could literally be passed in the air. But what he said was that no was the short answer in terms of the Irish view on it. He said the measures that we have implemented wouldn't have been successful if the virus was airborne. And we then got, we've heard this before, I suppose it's fairly gritty, but you need to hear it about literally how this virus is transmitted. He says when we cough or sneeze or talk, we generate respiratory droplets. They're different sizes. The large ones drop. The smaller ones take longer to fall to the floor. The weight of them is why there's that 1 or 2 metres. Some of them will only travel 1 metre. Some of them will only travel 2 metres. However, he said they don't have great evidence that the smaller particles are travelling, you know, in ventilation, for example. He said if people were... Essentially, if this was a purely airborne virus, then the R number, first of all, would be much higher. And then you would see people getting infected in an empty room. For example, you would have somebody with the virus in the room. They leave the room and then a person would walk in and be infected simply because it was airborne. He said they're not seeing that. They're not seeing it, for example, in ventilation shafts where it might have happened with other viruses. So I suppose there was a little bit of reassurance there.
OK, which brings us then finally to masks. We heard advisory to wear them, but it's not really getting more robust than that. And this is highly anecdotal. I'm just looking at my own experience of going to the supermarket. I'm often amongst the only people wearing a face covering.
Yeah, and I think we've all seen that. Tonight, NPHET is advising that visitors to healthcare settings, including hospitals, GP practices and pharmacies, should wear face coverings. But again, it's advisory or it's a recommendation. They made the point that not all people in those settings could wear face coverings. But yeah, I mean, any of us who are out and about can see that the majority of people aren't wearing them. And I suppose from my own, this is purely my own opinion, but I found it very interesting the take-up of the app, for example. We seem to be a nation that loves technology. You know, you saw the country immediately, a million people leap to download the app, which is great, and hopefully it will work. But you would imagine that if a million people were wearing masks, that might be useful as well. But the take-up just doesn't seem to be there on the same level. So we'll see now with the news tonight that that R number is increasing. You know, it was a somewhat more downbeat briefing, shall we say, than it had. You know, we've had several weeks of, the R number is down, things are going okay. And again, we were told tonight things are still fairly stable. You know, hospital admissions and ICU are still well down. Mm. However, they would come weeks after an increase in cases anyway. You know, if you follow the logic, first cases go up and then people get sick and then they end up in ICU. So things are still relatively stable, but there certainly were more notes of caution at tonight's briefing. So it'll be interesting to see if that does spill out into the community then, and if people decide to make mask wearing part of their daily lives.
Yeah, maybe people having blown the froth off their first couple of post-lockdown pints, if they were told that wearing a mask would prevent another lockdown, it might be a powerful incentive. Although
they're linking it with schools. You know, we've heard that before. If you want the message, I suppose they're trying to get out is if you want your schools back, if you want, you know, that to come back, then you have to take the precautions. And Dr. Glynn said a couple of times tonight, which I thought was interesting, you know, we can't keep acting like we did in January. You know, January was the halcyon days when the COVID was something we heard about, I suppose, at the tail end of the news bulletins, and it was way over there. But it's here now. And if people are having, you know, they can do certain normal things, they can do their bit of sport, they can go out, they can meet friends, but they have to act as if it is in the community, so they can't just go back to normal.
And we want that. We do want those schools back.
We certainly do.
We do. All right. Thanks a million, Sinead. We'll chat to you next week, maybe.
Thanks very much, Colin.
All the best. Cheers. Now, as I mentioned at the top, shortly we'll be getting the views of Irish people in Melbourne on the lockdown that's been reintroduced there with our reporter Jackie Fox. But first, Taiwan has been among the countries least affected by coronavirus fatalities. Now, it's an achievement all the more remarkable given Taiwan's proximity to China and the direct air links it had with Wuhan at the time of the outbreak. Relations with China are difficult for historical reasons, which I'm not going to go into now, but suffice to say that China's claim of sovereignty over Taiwan means that it has worked against Taiwan joining the UN and hence the World Health Organization, which explains to a large degree why Taiwan has not been held up as a model of best practice on the international stage. Now, given that Taiwan has been somewhat under the radar as a result of that partly, I thought it would be interesting to have a look at the experience there, and so-called Samson Ellis, Bloomberg's Taipei bureau chief, who agreed to take a call from me.
Hey there.
Hey, Samson, thanks very much. How long have you been in Taiwan?
That's a difficult question. So if you add it all together, about 13 years, but that's spread out over a 22-year period. So, you know, moved here, moved back, moved to Hong Kong, moved back. Yeah, over a 22-year period. I've lived here the majority of the last 22 years.
Okay, and were you there during SARS?
I was, yeah.
Right.
So 17 years ago now. And actually, I was living very close to the main hospital that proved to be the epicenter of the SARS outbreak here, where, you know, all the patients were sent and where they actually just, you know, without notice, just closed off the entire hospital with visitors and guests and nurses and doctors inside. No notice to those people either. That was 50 yards from where I was living at the time.
So when I last checked the Johns Hopkins University tracker, which is the go-to data tracker for this current pandemic, Taiwan was coming in at 7 fatalities. I mean, it's a stunningly low figure. How much of that has been coloured by their experience of SARS, which you saw firsthand the last time?
Oh, absolutely. Taiwan's success in handling the coronavirus is to a very large degree due to the fact that, you know, they dealt with the SARS virus 17 years ago and were, you know, either the second or the third most affected area during that outbreak. And back then, they reviewed how they dealt with the outbreak and they realized that there were a lot of weaknesses in their response, you know, and a lot of it is administrative, you know, it's coordination between government units, it's healthcare coordination, it's coordination between hospitals and clinics and doctors. And smaller doctors' offices and stuff like that. And so they realized they had to get up to speed in a very short period of time. So they developed a quite ingenious way to spread information to frontline doctors. And, you know, doctors are absolutely key in the response. And they've made that point this time here in Taiwan that, you know, doctors are the front line of this. They are the first people to notice new cases. And so you have to be talking very closely to your doctors, number one, you have to have this open pathway of communication, but you also have to train your doctors and let them know, look, this is what we do. You know, if you get a case that you think is a potential case, this is how you report it up the line, and this is what you do with them. And then smaller clinics and, you know, regional hospitals, this is how you guys should deal with it. This is how you isolate people properly. This is how you deal with wards. This is how you deal with staff. And so very quickly, they came up with a way to educate the entire healthcare system and also local governments and local authorities throughout Taiwan. And also they realized that legally there were some loopholes as well, that, you know, there were weaknesses or the deficiencies. There were things the government just simply couldn't do. And so they actually revised the law a couple of years after the SARS outbreak to give granting the government more power. But in times of crisis, sometimes you absolutely do need that. And I think it's proven this time that they were right to do so.
And what did those powers look like? Were we into full lockdown? Was there enforced quarantine? Did they shut the schools? How locked down was Taiwan when this first came on the horizon?
Yeah, Taiwan never went onto lockdown internally. What they did do is they stopped all travel to Taiwan. So Taiwan as a whole, it just shut down travel very, very quickly. So as soon as they heard rumors of a potential SARS-like virus in China, and remember that Taiwan watches China very, very closely for obvious political reasons. You know, China does threaten to invade Taiwan, and therefore Taiwan is watching what's happening in China very, very closely. In December last year already, they were seeing on Chinese social media, and so this was before, you know, the Chinese government had acknowledged that there was a problem, reported it to anyone. This was before the WHO reported anything. Taiwan already started boarding flights from Wuhan, which is, of course, where, you know, the first cases were reported in China. Boarding flights from Wuhan, and there were, you know, there are a lot of flights between Taipei and Wuhan, taking everybody's temperature, and anybody with any kind of symptoms, they were whisked away into quarantine immediately. Very shortly after that, they stopped all flights from Wuhan, and very shortly after that, they just decided only Taiwanese nationals and foreigners with residency permits are allowed into Taiwan.
Right. So on the basis, initially, at least, of internet chatter that they deemed to be credible intelligence, they acted to begin to restrict travel, or at least get into the preparatory phase to restrict travel.
Exactly, very, very quickly. In fact, they were a health delegation from Taiwan went to Wuhan a week, more than a week before the WHO even got there. So this is, you know, just kind of shows how on top of the situation they were. And, you know, they'd been through SARS. They knew how devastating it potentially could be. And especially if it came back worse, which is, you know, what we are seeing now. And so they were really alert to that. And so they acted incredibly quickly. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for how quickly they reacted. And you speak to health professionals here now, and they do credit the speed with which they reacted as having really helped them keep a control on the virus. And the numbers of, as you point out, just 7 deaths in total, around 450 cases in total since the beginning of the outbreak. And yeah, this was based on internet chatter, on internet boards in China that they'd seen. And I think this goes to a broader point. I mean, we're starting to see a bit of a, you know, a discussion about the efficacy of the WHO and its handling of this. And I think, you know, and Taiwan, you know, is not a member of the WHO, is not a member of the United Nations. And Taiwan does campaign very forcefully every year for some kind of access to the World Health Assembly, which is the decision-making body of the WHO. And, you know, they always get rejected. But I think in this case, this kind of does show that not being a part of the WHO actually benefited Taiwan in this case, because Taiwan knows it's on its own. It has to be alert. It has to take care of itself. And so, you know, they knew they had to take action very, very quickly.
And how did that affect the already somewhat strained and fraught relations Taiwan has with China? Because, as you say, a medical team went to Wuhan before the WHO. What kind of access do we know that they had, or how was that negotiated or managed between Taiwan and China? Was it a difficult thing?
There are still health contacts between Taiwan and China. So at the top level, you know, between leaderships, there's absolutely no contact right now. So since President Tsai Ing-wen was elected in 2016, she does not hold the view that Taiwan is part of China, and this for the government in Beijing, this crosses a red line. So they refuse to have any kind of contact with her. But previously existing, you know, contacts kind of further down the food chain administratively, those still exist. And you know, they're not perfect. You know, China passes on some information to Taiwan. Taiwan occasionally, you know, there's an email address that they email back and forth.
Literally.
With each other. Yes. And and so when Taiwan first noticed the changes, this potential outbreak, some Taiwanese health officials were invited by the health authorities in Wuhan, I think the Hubei provincial government, along with health officials from Hong Kong to go and visit. You know, they say they actually didn't get a whole lot of information, but the visit was very restricted in where they could and couldn't go. They were talking to the, you know, leaders in the hospitals there. They didn't give them a whole lot of information. And at the time, China was still denying that there was person-to-person transmission of this coronavirus, and you know, Taiwan was always had already locked down because they suspected there is human-to-human transmission. So but they did say they actually didn't glean a whole lot of really, really useful information from that visit.
Just going back, you mentioned that the WHO there, and the WHO has come into sharp focus, or its perceived deficiencies at least have come into sharp focus precisely almost because of Taiwan. Here we are with 7 fatalities, cases only in the hundreds. And yet it was never held up as the shining example, despite the fact, as you mentioned, there were direct flights to Wuhan. It's quite densely populated. So how has that gone down in Taiwan? And is it seen as part of the kind of global peace of people signing up to one China? Or has there been anger about it?
No, I think there's weary resignation in Taipei, certainly among healthcare professionals. Taiwan, despite how well it's performed during the coronavirus, people here realize that with the world as it currently is and with China as it currently is, there's very little prospect that Taiwan gets that kind of level of recognition that possibly it deserves. The WHO has taken, and its reputation certainly in Taiwan has taken a pretty good beating since the beginning of this, just because of the way they've handled it, the information they've provided. Taiwan always kind of felt, you know, we're one step ahead or two steps ahead of these guys and the information they're providing. And Taiwan, it does ultimately want to be a member of the WHO. And so it's being very careful to remain diplomatic in what it says about the WHO. And it, you know, keeps its messaging, certainly, you know, officially at least, to that, you know, we feel we can help, we can contribute, we want to be part of the global conversation on this.
Right. How did they manage things like PPE and that? Because in the rest of the world, there was a bit of a meltdown, to be fair, and there was competition between states to try and get PPE and source it in China. We were hearing reports of Americans intercepting PPE that was destined for Germany in Bangkok. I mean, it was the stuff of spy thrillers almost. But is Taiwan self-sufficient in that regard, or did it maintain those practical and pragmatic relations it has with China to a sufficiently open degree that it was able to import PPE from China?
Well, that's actually a fascinating example of the alacrity with which the government reacted here, I think. So I think, you know, on a broad level, people wear masks here. I mean, it's been a long-established practice. If you're in Taiwan, if you have a cold, if you have a bit of a sniffle, and you still, you know, not something not bad enough to keep you from going to work, so you still need to go, you wear a mask. You wear a mask to protect all the other people that you come into contact with on the bus, on the metro, and when you're in the office. That's seen here as basic courtesy. And so, but here you didn't really need a campaign or a public awareness campaign to kind of persuade people that, hey, masks are probably a good idea. People here already very much familiar with mask and mask wearing and, you know, how much it helps to prevent infections. So at the beginning of the outbreak, Taiwan is a, you know, manufacturing hub for, you know, electronics, but also textiles and a lot of other stuff. Taiwan made about 1.9 million masks a day, and they quickly realized, okay, we've got a population of 23.5 million. That's not enough to keep up with demand. If everybody needs a new mask every single day, we need to create more masks. They ramped up production very, very quickly. And this came from the government. The government said, essentially found some companies and said, right, you will ramp up production of masks and we are going to help you. We are going to help you pay for the machinery. We are going to help you run these machines. We are going to help you distribute all of these masks. And within 2 to 2.5 month period, they increased their output of face masks tenfold. So from about 1.9 million a day to 20 million a day.
Wow.
And part of this is a really smart, you know, political tactic, actually, to, and one of the worst things around pandemics is public panic. And this was just a measure to let people know, don't worry, you will be able to get a mask if you need one. Do not go out and hoard them. You don't need to scramble for them. Number one, that helps keep, you know, people at home calm and, you know, confident that, you know, the government is looking out for them, but also they will be able to protect themselves. But a secondary benefit of that is that Taiwan started producing so much that they were then able to actually start sending them overseas and, you know, made quite high profile donations to, you know, countries in Europe and obviously the United States and throughout Latin and South America as well. This just helped Taiwan win this PR war, if you like, that came out of the coronavirus with China.
Finally then, the economy in Taiwan, if it didn't go into lockdown internally and if it was exporting PPE, how much has the international picture affected Taiwan given the level of global drop-off we've seen?
Well, that's a really interesting question right now. So, you know, we at Bloomberg, we obviously look at the economy very, very closely. And one thing we're seeing, a very interesting picture, is that the government and economists in Taiwan think that the Taiwanese economy this year will likely grow between 1 and 1.5%. And if it does that, it will be the only, it would likely be the only developed economy in the world to grow at all this year. Every other developed economy in the world will most likely contract this year. And so there's a bit of a debate going on between economists, you know, and largely it's divided between economists in Taiwan and economists outside of Taiwan about will Taiwan's economy contract or not. And economists here really do think that the local economy will withstand the impact of the virus. And that's largely because now that actually you can't travel or you can barely travel, you have a lot of people who would otherwise travel abroad for holidays or travel abroad for travel. Also, you have a lot of people who would otherwise, you know, business owners, factory owners who otherwise live in China, and these are wealthy people in Taiwan, that they are actually now moving back to Taiwan or staying in Taiwan longer than they otherwise would do. And so what you're actually seeing is that certainly in terms of domestic consumption, we'll likely see a bump this year. Exports have held up despite the fact that demand from the rest of the world would otherwise give you cause for concern. But actually what you're seeing, because Taiwan does export technology products, the coronavirus has actually proved to be a bit of a boon for that, because people are buying iPads and laptops like crazy so that they can work that from home all over the world.
Well, listen, Samson, it's been fascinating talking to you. I could probably talk to you for a whole lot longer. I take it, seeing as we're recording this in the middle of the week, you at least are free to go out and enjoy a meal or a drink in a bar at the weekends, should you so choose.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been minimal impact to, you know, ordinary life in Taiwan. And I think that again, just shows the importance of taking action early, and even if it's to essentially lock down the country. But, you know, take a smaller action early will stop you having to, like, you know, for example, in Britain, we've seen that you're having to, you know, shut down absolutely everything and stop everybody even leaving their homes. Here, we've always been able to go to restaurants. We've always been able to travel around Taiwan. We can go and watch films if we want to.
Right. Well, I think any of our listeners who's had to homeschool children and cancel foreign holidays this year listens to you with a certain degree of envy. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Absolutely welcome. Thank you.
To Melbourne now, and for the next 6 weeks, 5 million people will be confined to their homes except for essential journeys. So what's it like for residents to be back in lockdown? RTE's Foreign Desk reporter Jackie Fox put out a call for Irish people living in Australia's second largest city to make contact with her and talk about their experience. Jackie Fox has been catching up with a few of them and spoke to me earlier. Okay, Jackie, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm not too bad. You've been looking at Melbourne, sadly, not up close, or rather fortunately not up close, given what's going on. Can you give us a bit of background? How did Melbourne as it is today come about? Because people may not have realised just how this crept up.
Yeah, people may be a bit confused about this, because for months Australia had felt optimistic about containing COVID-19. And I think it's safe to say that the world looked on in envy as everything started to open back up on the other side of the world down under. But then came the resurgence of the virus in Melbourne. So at the weekend, officials in Melbourne locked down about 3,000 people living in 9 housing estate tower blocks, as in people were not allowed to leave under any circumstances. That's after only 23 cases of infection were found, and more have been found since. So people might have seen pictures of police outside these buildings to make sure people were adhering to the rules to stay inside as everyone was tested. What concerns the authorities had, though, was that local transmission was the key source of infection. So previously, most cases came from travellers returning from overseas. Red flags were raised as well due to potential quarantine breaches. You might remember in Australia, you were brought to a hotel to quarantine for 14 days on arrival into the country. And officials believe that these possible breaches led to returnees spreading the virus. So all this came to a head when officials decided to reimpose restrictions after the state of Victoria recorded its largest single day increase of almost 200 new cases on Tuesday.
OK, so what does the lockdown mean, or what does it look like?
Well, Melbourne, the city, Australia's second biggest city, is back in lockdown for 6 weeks. There is a heavy police clampdown affecting 5 million people, with checkpoints set up around Melbourne to ensure people stay at home. State police said they would conduct random checks on vehicles on major roads surrounding the country's second most populous city, creating what they were calling a ring of steel. The busiest border between Victoria, where Melbourne is, and New South Wales was closed for the first time in over 100 years. And actually, the last time it was closed was in 1919 due to the Spanish flu pandemic. You need a permit to cross, otherwise you could be arrested or fined up to €7,000. And it doesn't end with internal travel restrictions either. Scott Morrison, Australia's Prime Minister, said his government is considering imposing more international travel restrictions. And that's tough for the Irish people in Melbourne, considering there's so many over there. We've got a great connection with Australia. Irish people, they're so far away and unable to travel. And I've been speaking to Tipperary woman Michelle O'Donnell, who has been in Australia for 12 years and is currently living in Melbourne.
I think we had all thought, yay, fantastic. We can start to book holidays. We can start to plan. We can start to, you know, live our life again and meet friends, and we were all really looking forward to just going for a drink with each other. Even having Christmas in July, which is a big thing here, which now all those plans are put on hold. So I think everyone was looking towards the end, and now it's another 6 weeks away, which just is really disappointing and devastating for some people. So for me, really, yeah, it is the whole thing of, you know, not being able to travel interstate when you have a sister here is challenging, especially, you know, she's just had a new baby. So, you know, you're not allowed to even go interstate. So,
did you have plans to come back to Ireland at any stage? Because obviously that's difficult to be so far away.
Yeah. So originally in March when it all started, my father was ill in Ireland and I really, really wanted to get home. And normally I would be on a flight home. I was advised by work then that if I did go, I'd be quarantined for 2 weeks on the way back. So even trying to get home, it was kind of like a thing of, right, I had to quarantine for 2 weeks on that side, and then I have to quarantine for 2 weeks on this side. And the challenge as a mom was that I'm quarantining on this side, I'd be put into a hotel and in the room for 2 weeks with a toddler and not able to get out. So yeah, plans to go home completely stopped, which I think has made everybody feel over here, especially us who are parents, that we've never felt so far away and so far removed from home. We always could just get on a flight, and it's kind of made us feel, I know from speaking with other friends, it's just very isolating, and you really feel the distance.
All right, well, that was Michelle O'Donnell from Tipperary, but as you said, as you introduced her, they're currently living in Melbourne. So tell us about what's closed, Jackie.
Well, Melbourne residents, they'll be allowed during this lockdown to leave home only for essential business over the next week, 6 weeks. Cafes, bars, restaurants and gyms are all shut again. Brona McKenna from St. Kevin's GAA Club in Melbourne said they are frustrated that teams won't be able to start their seasons, but understand completely that the lockdown is needed to curb the spread of the virus. Brona, who's from Monaghan, added that she's one of the lucky ones that as her job is safe, but she knows people on temporary visas in Australia, like working holiday visas and students who are actually heading home because they don't have much support over there. Scott Morrison, the Australian Prime Minister, said in early April that those on student visas or those visiting who can't support themselves in Australia should go home. People may know to extend these visas, you may have to work on a farm. And Brona said that some are remaining on the farm in the hope that they can stay in the country.
Yeah, definitely at the start of the pandemic, there was a lot of people that left our football club. And there was some people that stuck it out. But now I'd say there will be more people returning home But most people that are on the farm are staying on the farm because there's no jobs coming up in cities anymore. So I would say that there'll be a lot of people that will feel like they've wasted their working holiday visa and will have to return back to Ireland because they've no support out here.
Yeah, that was Brona McKenna there from Monaghan, but living in Melbourne. And it's a predicament for employers to Annette O'Donnell. She's the owner of the Galtee Cafe in Melbourne. The Limerick woman told me that her business can still offer takeaways during this surreal time, which is welcome news for her. But as she outlines here, she's still trying to help and reassure her Irish employees.
The main issues are for the staff. So last weekend I'd have 5-6 staff on at the weekend, but now I'm probably going to be down to like 1-2 staff at the weekend. So it's a big issue for them on working holiday visas, student visas that don't have any support over here. So us as employers trying to, you know, spread the shifts, trying to give them hours so that they can pay their bills and, you know, continue to support them over here.
That must be worrying, you know, for everyone involved, for yourself and as employer, but them on those visas.
Exactly. Like yesterday when they announced the shutdown, one of my staff members was looking for flights home back to Ireland. So I rang her and I was like, listen, I'll try my best. I'll give you some shifts. We're not shutting down completely. We will do what we can to stay open. And it's just for her. She's like, oh my God, thank you. It'll help. You know, at least she can stay and make a plan here and doesn't have to jump on a plane back to Ireland to no job there either. So we can only do the best we can and try spread it around, and hopefully there's a great Irish community over here, so they do tend to support each other, and everyone loves an Irish breakfast roll, so they tend to come to Galtee for that. So we'll still continue to do that during takeaways.
And that was Annette O'Donnell from Limerick. So finally then, a cautionary note from somebody from my own hometown.
Yeah, another woman I spoke to is Sarah Kenny from Naas in County Kildare. She just had a baby girl 2 weeks ago and was up in the middle of the night doing a feed when she responded to my call out for Irish people in Melbourne to give her reaction to everything that's happening over there at the moment.
We're coming into our winter here in Melbourne as well, which just makes it a little bit tougher because you really are stuck inside all of the time. And I mean, we've got two small kids. You can imagine what everyone knows what that's like. Just trying to juggle everything.
Did you have any plans to go back to Ireland this year?
So we've just had a baby 2 weeks ago, and my parents were due to come over like last week. So they obviously couldn't come over. We were sort of thinking of heading back around October, November, but sort of at this stage, we don't know when the family is going to get to meet her. So that's a little bit frustrating and disappointing as well.
A lot of FaceTimes and Zooms until things are safe.
FaceTime and Zoom and holding the baby up and, you know, doing what we can. But I guess it probably would have been the same being in Ireland with everyone under lockdown anyway. I mean, I've seen friends, you know, holding their baby up in the window for the grandparents, whereas with us it's on FaceTime. I think we're really feeling over here that the same thing could definitely happen in Ireland in a few weeks' time with the relaxation of restrictions, and it can happen so quickly. A few days ago, we sort of thought we were okay, and then, boom, they locked down
Yeah, words of warning there from Sarah Kenny. And both Sarah and Michelle O'Donnell, who we've heard from earlier, they both agreed that people had become more complacent in recent weeks, whether that was a lack of social distancing or not using hand sanitizer. So what she was saying there, a gentle reminder to Irish listeners to stay safe during this time, I think.
Okay, thanks for that, Jackie. And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back next week with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or you can contact me on Twitter at colmomongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. Thanks for listening.